Welcome to Guerrilla Radio, recorded May 15th, 2024. Well, the Gaza genocide is accelerated. Now at the gates of the southern city of Rafah, heavy bombing over the weekend, described by refugees of Israel's seven-plus months-long razing of the walled enclave as the most intense experienced yet. As hundreds of America's largest bombs rained on the estimated 1.5 million Palestinians driven into Rafah, the Israeli military bombed two areas in north and central Gaza, where many have returned to the ruins of their homes after finding no safety in the south. Protest against Israel's blatant criminality has come from every quarter of international governance and on the streets of cities and college campuses around the world. And yet the slaughter continues. Dave Lindorf is an Izzy Award-winning investigative journalist, author, founder of the web news site This Can't Be Happening, and co-producer of the documentary A Compassionate Spy. The film tells the tale of Ted Hall, wunderkind physicist and spy, who may well have saved Russia and the world from nuclear conflagration. It's also the subject of Lindorf's companion book for the film, Spy for No Country. Dave's latest article at This Can't Be Happening, covering America's reaction to the Gaza genocide, is The Protesters on the Nation's Campuses Are Winning. Dave Lindorf in the first half. And the late American poet Maya Angelou famously said, "When someone shows you who they are, believe them the first time." In Canada's case, behind its liberal humanist rhetoric, what it has shown time and again is a ruthless devotion to capitalist ventures at home and abroad. Viviana Herrera is Latin America Program Coordinator for Mining Watch Canada. And what they're looking at right now is the surging violence surrounding Canadian mining projects in Ecuador. Viviana Herrera and watching Canada's efforts to set up a new investor-state dispute settlement with Ecuador in the second half. But first, Dave Lindorf and the draconian tactics of corrupt and gutless college leaders to try and shut down protests against Israeli genocide in Gaza. Welcome to the program, Dave.
Yeah, thanks for being for calling me and working out these technical problems.
Well, happy to be here in this beautiful technological age that we live in. Dave, before we get into the whole college demos, speaking of technology, there's been big changes at This Can't Be Happening since we spoke in the autumn. What's going on over there?
Well, we made the decision that we would go to Substack because, you know, we've been doing this for free for all this time since 2010 and hoping that people would make, you know, donations to support the work. But the donations have been pathetic. People just like to get their stuff free. But Substack seems to have a good system going. So what we've done right now is we're doing it for free and building up a subscriber base on Substack and getting our people who, you know, our regular readers to move over. So we're getting more and more subscriptions. And at some point, we're going to put the fence up and see how many will come over as subscribers.
Well, you know, I've done that with my site, and I know exactly what you're saying, because I just got hit with massive server bills. I'm not sure if they're real or if it's like, you know, robots and all this other stuff. You know, I'm still a 20th century man after all over here.
Yeah, I'm going to try before I go to a full pay thing. I'm going to have set up a podcast that's available to paid subscribers only and see whether that helps. That's one of the things that Substack said is good. But I would encourage people to come over to the site. It's now at thiscan'tbehappening.substack.com. And it's mostly me at this point because my comrades are even more pathetic at figuring out new things online than I was. And I've got it down to a science. It's a very simple site to work with, but it's beyond my colleagues. So we'll see how I'm going to have to like really sit down with each one of them and go through it so that they can post.
It's a teachable moment. So it's thiscan'tbehappening.substack.com, and there's no apostrophe between the N and T. thiscan'tbehappening.substack.com. Dot com. I'm looking at the site right now, actually, Dave, and I'm looking at your article. The protesters on the nation's campuses are winning, you say. How so? How, what I see is students being having the crap beaten out of them by policemen and by pro-genocide goons. How are they winning?
Well, I'm saying that they're winning because, first of all, they put this issue on the map. Before the Columbia protest started, there was really very little talk in the media about the genocide in Palestine, in Gaza. And, you know, you got, in fact, mostly negative, saying that, you know, that it wasn't being, it wasn't really a court issue at the International Court of Justice, you know, and you just didn't see it in the papers. And when this thing broke out at Columbia, and when Columbia overreacted, it then started a movement across the campuses across the country. It's over 500 college campuses having these protests. I think that's a huge win.
Not only in the States, but here in Canada, too, and in Europe as well.
Yeah, Australia, Europe. It's true.
And the Middle East, I understand there's, of course, this is at the very end of the college calendar. So what happens next is a burning question. You know, I was speaking, Dave, recently with Laith Marouf of FreePalestine.video. He's a Palestinian-Canadian who left Canada to do his journalism work from Beirut. But I brought up the point that you just mentioned, that the student movement here on the, as you say, it brought attention to this issue. But I was saying, well, wasn't it their danger of the campus sit-ins and resistance overshadowing the reason for that resistance being the genocide going on in Gaza right now? What do you think about that?
I think that, you know, I mean, from my perspective, I think, you know, that first of all, it is raising the issue very, very powerfully, especially because of the involvement of young, mostly young Jewish Americans who are putting themselves on the line. And, you know, it makes a joke out of calling it anti-Semitic. Jewish Voices for Peace and several other organizations of anti-Zionist Jews representing a pretty sizable chunk of the Jewish population in the U.S. They have 400,000 members, 460,000 members. I think it's growing. So that's pretty significant. The second thing is that this is a real change in the thinking of a lot of young people now, because they're finding out the importance of protest as opposed to just getting online and signing on to petitions and stuff. So this is really, you know, they're sort of entering the 60s and finding out what repression is and not giving in, and the importance of sticking it out.
You mentioned that the change in technology and how you and some of your comrades that are 60s veterans, and not necessarily veterans of the war, but veterans of that protest moment, are a little at sea in this new technological moment. There's been a lot of comparison to the 1968 convention in Chicago, which is where the Democratic convention this year, by fate, is meant to happen. What do you think of the notion that this might become a virtual or online convention only, given the nervousness about this very physical convention being a magnet for protests from all over the country?
Well, it could be, and we could get Trump the way we got Nixon, you know. it's true that you know, people are angry now, and they're not going to take lying down, being shut out of the convention. But we're entering a new era, a new era of protest, a new era of anger. You know, it's hard to see at this point, make predictions of how it's going to go, because Biden is sinking fast, because he's both trying to play two things at once, saying, oh, I care about the Palestinians. Not enough. Too many of them are being killed. I don't know what enough or appropriate number killed is to Biden, but it's a pretty pathetic position to take. And then, you know, delivering all these bombs and shells again to Israel, despite knowing that they're pummeling the Palestinians that he thinks they've already killed too many of, doesn't make him look particularly strong or project any kind of leadership or moral thinking. So I think it's portraying him in a way that he either has to shake this off and take a strong stand to put a stop to this horrible war or repression. It's hard to call it a war, by the way.
Well, this is a genocide. This is it fits every single parameter. In fact, I think it's transcended that, and I've written about this myself, is that what we are seeing now is a Holocaust. This is an entire forming to be an entire erasure of a people. If you read Ralph Nader, these numbers of dead, he says, are vastly underestimated. He's thinking absolutely. There's more than 200,000 have perished already, says Ralph.
So, and in one of my pieces, I did a photo side by side of the Warsaw Ghetto after the Jewish ghetto in Warsaw after the uprising there and the pummeling that the Nazis did on that with, you know, planes bombing them and everything, and Gaza. And they look exactly alike, the two cities.
Or Leningrad or something like that. But Israel has gone one step further. They're bringing these armored bulldozers made by Caterpillar in the United States of America to level flat. I mean, there's not even the rubble, and they're just scraping. This is, you talk about a scorched earth. This is scorched, raised, paved, and set up for, some would say, real estate development in a post-Palestinian Gaza.
On the bodies of the people that were in those buildings, because many, many people were just crushed under the rubble, and the Palestinians didn't have equipment to come in and lift the blocks and get two people even. So I'm sure a lot of people died who were trapped.
Well, Dave, when you talk about Biden, there's a school of thought that the United States is not trying to stop anything. They're a partner in this, and they have been from the very beginning, from before it started. Biden can't withstand and claim some kind of innocence or even fecklessness, according to this school of thought, because they are the engine behind what's going on now, for whatever purpose we'll find out, perhaps, and Israel is merely the point of the spear.
Yeah, well, that's what been its role in the Middle East, is the country that the U.S. relied on to do its dirty work in the Middle East. But that's been, you know, that's been true for basically almost every president since the founding of the Israeli state. And so, I mean, oddly enough, Reagan probably stood up better to Israel than Biden ever will. The other thing is that I think that this has exposed the shabbiness of our media, because they're doing things like the Wall Street Journal and the Times and all and everybody, but including AP, they have these macros that we used to call them, you know, where you get a paragraph that you can plug into a story, and that over and over when you do the story, you plug in the macro. And the macro is, every time they talk about these horrors, they say, you know, that this all began with the with October 7th and the brutal attack on that killed 1,200 Israelis. And, you know, it's the same words. I've checked it over and over. It's just the editors are plugging these things in. I don't even know whether the reporters are doing it because they're told this macro in every time you do a story, or whether the copy editors just do it when it comes to their desk. Because it's shameful. It's wrong. It leaves out the entire historical background to why there was this, you know, attack planned and carried out on October 7th. That followed 17 years of occupation and of Israeli blocking of aid of any kind into Gaza. It's been a starvation diet for Gaza in the, for 17 years since Hamas came in. And they never mentioned that Hamas was created by Shin Bet.
Yeah, well, and all, well, the, and the history goes even further back than that. I mean, we can really go back right to the beginning. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Dave Lindorf. Dave's an Izzy Award-winning investigative journalist, author, founder of the web news site This Can't Be Happening, now over at Substack. And he's co-producer of the documentary film A Compassionate Spy, the film released in the autumn. It tells the tale of Ted Hall, wunderkind physicist and spy who may well have saved Russia and the world from nuclear conflagration, including you and your parents and everything you know. And it's a subject of Dave's book, a companion book for the film Spy for No Country, that's out now and doing well, I understand, Dave. His latest article we're speaking around is The Protesters on the Nation's Campuses Are Winning. That is, again, at thiscan'tbehappening.substack.com. Well, Dave, when you talk, I don't know that there's any editors left. I think those are probably all AI robots that are plugging those stories in. And that's maybe why they just petition or are yelling against a stone wall. But it's not only the press. We're seeing the pillars of all of Western society crumbling before us, not least of which is the idea of higher education. In early October, after the attack of the 7th that you mentioned, I saw an article, I think it was in the 12th of October, where universities were coming under it. This is way before there was any kind of camps or anything like that. But by the Zionist faction within the United States, universities were coming under attack already for their what was perceived to be too tepid response to the horrors of the attack and so forth and so on. But it makes it clear to me that there was a plan in place to erode the place within the culture of higher education.
Can you back me up on that? That has been going on for several decades. There was a campaign by the an Association of Board of Trustees members that was headed up by Senator Lieberman and by Cheney's wife. I forget her first name.
Lynn Cheney?
Lynn Cheney.
Lynn, yeah.
Lynn Cheney. And they had a campaign to attack the whole liberal education agenda with a, you know, then turn it conservative. And one of their memos was, you know, one, I can't remember which one of them wrote it, that, you know, well, we've gotten public education under our control, and now we have to get higher ed under our control. And that's
who's the hour in this? Is this the Project for a New American Century or the neoconservative?
Yeah, it's that same group. It's the but it's, you know, they're trying to work it through the whole strategy was to work it through having corporate boards that would exert control over the content of the education in the higher ed. And that's what they're doing. They've made a concerted attack on faculty governance that's pretty much won the day in almost everywhere. And now, you know, in any of the important committees, the faculties only have advisory roles now. They don't really, the excuse for barring private universities faculties from having trade unions was that the labor board ruled that faculty were their own bosses, which at one time was largely true, but it's not in any school that I can think of is that true any longer.
Well, at one school in particular, it really seems to be the epitome of what's going on right now, and that's Columbia. It was where the nascent protest movements began, arguably. at least became most visible. Columbia is the home of the Pulitzer Prizes. It's the home of the most prestigious journalism training in the country. And it's run by a woman, Manoush Baroness Shafik. she is, as Max Blumenthal over at the excellent grayzone.com describes, that she's really the epitome of everything that we're seeing here. She's connected to spook agencies, to police agencies, to the very highest echelons of this whole New World Order machinations. She's a Brit, American, Egyptian, tripartite national. What do you know about Manoush, Dave?
Well, I know not that much about Manoush other than that she's a baroness in England, which sort of says it all. I mean, that is not where you look for any kind of progressive thought or concerns about the common person. I will say that I went to the Columbia Journalism School. The Pulitzer Prizes are a massive joke. All I need to say is that Bob Scheer was put up with a nomination by the Los Angeles Times at, I think it was 7 times to the Pulitzers, any one of which he deserved, and he didn't get one. I put in my book on the Mumia Abu-Jamal case for a Pulitzer, and my publisher put in the impeachment book that I did on the grounds for impeaching Cheney and Bush. And, you know, it didn't even get into a, you know, initial consideration. I think most serious writers on the left just look at the Pulitzers as a joke. I wouldn't even bother to submit this book that I've got out now. It would be a complete waste of time and money.
Well, Robert Scheer was one of the first guys to a high stature journal to walk away from, in disgust and go online. And the Scheer Report, I think it's still on, right?
Yeah, I was on it just 2 months ago.
Well, Dave, we're fast running out of time, but I mean, so here we are heading for the hot days of summer. The schools will close. We'll see. And when you mention the impeachment, now there's been an impeachment process begun for Biden for not providing more weapons quickly enough or something, I'm not even sure, to Israel in the middle of this genocidal campaign, much as his predecessor, Trump, was impeached for not giving enough weapons quickly enough to Ukraine. It's beyond parody. But, Dave, what do you think we should be watching now? What happens next in America when the campuses close, the encampments perhaps decamp, and that sense of outrage that's just boiling beneath the surface in America, not over many issues that have been left unaddressed for way too long. Now, what can we expect?
Well, I think they've got a momentum that's probably going to carry over in the summer into street protests and maybe Washington protests. I mean, there certainly is the momentum to do that. There's a lot of anger at the way that they use the police. There was a survey just out. I can't remember who did it. Might have been Politico, of 500 campuses that had, you know, the police come in and roust the people from the campuses. And they found that 97% were completely peaceful. And the other 3 were largely responses to the police attacks on them.
Or provocateurs.
I mean, this is just it's so beyond an outrage that I can't believe it. I mean, I went to the Columbia protest and looked at, you know, I went with a group of radical elders who were all people who had participated in a college takeover in 68, either at Columbia or at other campuses in sympathy occupations. And I mean, this was the original Occupy movement in 68 in the spring. And We went over, there were 12 of us, and we were stopped, of course, at the gate on 116th Street and Broadway, so we could only peek through the grill to see what was happening. It was completely peaceful. People were walking around on the sidewalks unobstructed. They never did block the sidewalks, and it was the least interfering protest I'd ever seen on the Columbia campus, where I spent a number of years, both as a undergraduate general studies Chinese major, and then as a journalism school master's student. And when we had protests, we took the sidewalks, or we took the stairs, or we went into buildings.
Well, they say, the streets, whose streets are streets. Well, they're now sitting on the grass saying, like, whose grass? Our grass. Dave, we're out of time. This, I was going to say, because when you mentioned your book on the impeachment of Bush, that brings you and I full circle, because I think that was the first time you and I spoke back in 2004 or five or something like that.
2006.
Six, yeah, almost.
Was the Mumia book.
Yeah, almost 20 years. Dave, thanks a lot. Everybody, watch for Dave's stuff. Go over to Substack, thiscan'tbehappening.substack.com, and support journalism. It's desperately needed, and people can't live on air and good wishes and your prayers. Thanks a lot, Dave, for coming on again. And I hope we can talk again during the summer.
Yeah, absolutely. And we'll see whether this continues.
And remember to go check out Dave's book, Spy for No Country, and the film, A Compassionate Spy. Talk to you the next time, Dave.
Okay, so long.
And I want everyone else to stick around, because Viviana Herrera is going to be on. She's from Mining Watch Canada. We're going to talk about Canada's deal-making going on right now in the mining industry, Ecuador, and it's concerning. Thanks again, Dave.
Moscow, Tokyo, New York. Guerrilla Radio is everywhere. Online at guerrilla-radio.com. Everywhere, all the time.
Chicago, Jakarta, Helsinki, Cape Town, Sao Paulo, Manchester, Bangalore, and somewhere in Russia I can't actually remember the name of.
In the Congress and the Bundestag, you'll see them wring their hands and say how they wish in hindsight they had tried to understand, how they wish they'd seen the warning signs and heard the generals speak and believed them when they talked about the vengeance they would wreak, how they should have known this was not idle conversation, how they should have listened harder when they said elimination. Yes, once it's all too late and the graveyards are all filled, once the last Palestinians killed. On Manhattan Island, in the halls of the UN, the whole world will come together to say never again. They'll open a museum full of relics of the past before those who used to live there resisted to the last. We'll look at pictures of the rubble with the dead limbs poking through. The viewers will shed a tear and wish the leaders knew before the war ended in the way Ben-Gavir had willed, once the last Palestinians killed. In the parliament, they'll say, perhaps we should have listened instead of purging Europe's biggest party of internal opposition. Should have paid attention to the millions in the streets, to those massive crowds around the globe voting. Should have read the signs, should have listened to their words instead of denouncing all the talk of genocide is just absurd. Should have looked at the pictures of the bodies charred and grilled, once the last Palestinians killed. When that last tower block was flattened, in the days before the last bakery was bombed, in this total war, when there were still kindergartens, when the hospital still stood, this would have been the time to question if we should have been sending all those weapons instead of barring them complete. If instead of cheering on the evil enemy's defeat, we might have asked if there was anywhere left for flour to be milled, once the last Palestinians project is complete, and they make the desert bloom once they've finished turning cities into tombs, once the dead are out of sight and buried in the ground, once the rubble has been bulldozed and no one hears the sound of